Baptist in America, the struggle for religious freedom. We found out in our last classes that we had whole churches moving from more civilized areas, because there was a lot of religious persecution, into white wilderness in Kentucky. Now we have a problem coming into the Baptist ranks with heresy, and many of the Baptists at this time were not really highly educated, especially not in the languages. And they were trying to get schools started with association-backed schools, and they were doing some progress, but there was the ministers and the churches would fall prey to universalism and Unitarian and different heresies, Arianism, that Jesus Christ was not really God in the flesh, which is a basic doctrine of the Bible. And page 299, it says, from this date on, the Baptists consistently opposed Unitarianism. When Dr. Hawley, a Unitarian minister from Boston, was elected president of Transylvania University, he was deserted by three leading denominations of Christians, the Baptists, the Methodists, and the Presbyterians, and the school was sinking and must perish without change. Remember, these schools were religious schools. They were seminaries. They were colleges, but they were seminaries at the time. And now we have a heretic, a Unitarian Armenian heretic, get a hold of the school. And now, instead of educating the students, they are being brainwashed. Isn't that what happened in America the last 15 or 20 years with our young people? They were fed wokeism and anti-American philosophy, to where we have a whole generation of anti-American citizens, so-called. About this time in South Kentucky Association, a separate Baptist, a popular minister, John Bailey, embraced the sentiments of the Restorationists and the Universalists. He was generally believed to be a pious man, and a majority of the association was devotedly attached to him, and insisted, although he had preached this doctrine. Now, what is this Restorationist? Okay, this is all Unitarian. This is all Unitarian philosophy. A Restorationist doctrine means that when you die, you're preached to again, and you're going to be restored. Because you are no longer living in this horrible body, you're going to restore it and you get to go to heaven. In other words, there is no eternal hell at all. See, your Universalist, Unitarian Universalist, your Mary Baker Eddy, your Jehovah Witnesses, your Seventh-day Adventist, all of these are affected with this heresy. And here it came among Baptists. Whether the association, the Hell Redemption is what it was called, Hell Redemption, as it was called, first came up in the association in 1791. Bailey had been preaching this doctrine, and William Bledsoe also embraced it. The association took action as follows. Whether the association will hold a member in society that propagates the doctrine of restoration from hell, agreed they would not. Bailey voted in the affirmative, and two others were neutral. A presbytery was appointed to examine Bailey and demand of him his credentials if it was thought fit. In other words, you can't be preaching, you can't have a license to preach or your ordination if you're preaching hell redemption. This is the basic doctrine of the Bible. James Smith, one of the committee, was accused of saying that he believed that all men for whom Christ died would be saved. This accusation was proved. Upon this, his examination, the association agreed that he did not teach redemption from hell. Now, what it means to all those that Jesus Christ died for, this is the elect. This is limited atonement. They would tolerate limited atonement, but they weren't going to tolerate redemption from hell. In other words, the doing away of hell, eternal hellfire, no longer a doctrine. At this juncture, the body saw fit to agree to abide by the plan upon which the churches of our union were constituted in October 1787 and May 1788. The way was open in 1799 for the return of Bailey without inquiring into his private sentiments, provided he lived an orderly life. He was a brilliant orator and a popular man, and there were many divisions and much strife. The associations of the state ceased correspondence with him. The association entered many loose opinions and finally went off with the anti-missionary movement. You know what the anti-missionary movement is? That's Hardshell. When you add one heresy, then another heresy comes. When you accept one heresy, then you accept another heresy, and another heresy, and another heresy. Page 301. The settlement of Kentucky brought vast changes in other sections of the Ohio Valley. The movements were here involved almost the entire early history of this country. At first, the territory was largely under the influence of the French Roman Catholics. The Jesuit missionaries were often in advance of even the explorer and the fur trader, while he was eagerly seeking to make converts of the Indian tribes. The missions planted by him became centers of Roman Catholic colonization and slavery. Every time they established a mission, it was a slave plantation. There were more American Indian slaves in America than there were ever black slaves. And the Catholic Church was basically guilty of the most of this. While such adventures as La Salle and Joliet and Nicolet were extending westward and southward the limits of discovery, Marquet and his associates were no less active and with no less of daring and self-sacrifice in preparing the way for what was meant should be a definite and permanent settlement in the country of the Catholic Church. Soldiers and fur traders followed where these pioneers of the church led way. This Catholic Church wanted to get in and get a foothold before anybody else could and try to keep everybody else out. Demand that no other religion be taught. The forts were built here and there throughout the country, and the cabins of the settlers clustered about the mission homes, the mission house, the mission. And of course, the slaves of this mission were the American Indians. The new colonists, immigrants from Canada, or disbanded soldiers of French regiments, however wild in their habits of life, were devout Catholics. They were wild, hellish people, but they were devout Catholics. Catholicism was never a religion of piety, regardless, especially on the part of the laity. Every little community of them gathered there was a center of the Roman Catholic faith. The missionaries were animated, no doubt, in the main by intense desire for the conversion of the native tribes. To convert the native tribes, then you got slaves without cost. You don't have to buy them. While the colder apostles of Protestantism labored on the outskirts of the heathendom, these champions of the cross, the forlorn hope of the army of Rome, pierced to the heart, its dark and dreary domain, confronted death at every step, and were well repaid for all. Could they but sprinkle a few drops of water on the forehead of a child and hang a golden crucifix around its neck as some warrior and please with a glittering trinket. Catholicism is a religion of outward show. It's a religion of circumstance and pomp. As intimated in the first words of the above extract, Protestantism found no fervid championship. The day was to come when a different form of effort for conversion of the natives would have been made by ministers of a truer faith, not making them slaves. The whole prospect was to make these people slaves, and the Catholic Church is a religion of slavery. Everybody does what it says. You move when they say move. You cross yourself when they say cross yourself. This is it. with better results than those just described. At this time, Protestantism was represented simply in the person of the American pioneer seeking a home further and further into the depths of the Western wilderness. Perhaps with his religious instructor, a guide sharing with him the rude conditions of the wilderness of life. Perhaps not yet, in either case, representing the ideas which must mean Western development, something far different from all that appeared in the Jesuit missionary or the Canadian settler. Under such conditions, collisions were inevitable. As French adventurers and colonists moved westward by the way of Great Lakes. Now remember, some of these other Indians are walking off and they're walking around here and they're seeing their fellow man made into slavery in the name of a religion. And they began to fight. And then it was very hard for the American Baptist people to go into these areas and convince them that loved them and God loved them when they had been made slaves and had been tortured. Moved westward by way of the Great Lakes and southward and westward to the Ohio and the Mississippi, they found after a time their right of occupancy disputed. They couldn't stay there. Meantime, while French and English were contending on the battlefields in Europe, it could not fail to happen whether ever representatives of these two nationalities should meet in the New World, it must be as enemies and not as friends. The conquest of the country by General George Rogers Clark in 1778 and the organization of civil government by Virginia opened the way for an American immigration. All of the rich domain northwest of the Ohio was secured to the public at the peace of 1783 in a consequence of the prowess of Clark. The larger portion of these first American settlers came from Virginia and Maryland. While a few had received a rudimentary education and had lived among communities which may be said to have been conspiratorily cultured, the most of them were hardy and rough and uncultivated backwoodsmen. They had been accustomed only to the ways of the frontier and the camp. Many of them had served in the War of the Revolution, and all of them in the border wars with the Indians. While they were brave, hospitable, and generous, they were more or at ease beneath the forest bivouac than in the living room of the log cabin, and to swing a woodsman's axe among the lofty trees of the primeval forest was a pursuit far more congenial to their rough nature and active temperament than to mingle with society and settled communities. They were mountain men. They were trailblazers. As you'll go across the Nevada line, it says you're in pioneer country. And a lot of Nevada is like that still to this day. Their habits and manners were plain, simple, and unostentatious. Their clothing was generally made of the dress skins of the deer and the wolf and the fox, and while those of the buffalo and elk supplied with them covering for their feet and hands and the floors. Their log cabins were destitute of glass, nails, and hinges, or locks. Glass, nails, hinges, or locks. When a man went into the wilderness, if he took some nails with him, he took those square nails like we have some of. They took those square nails, and if he moved from that location, he burned that cabin down, and he took a magnet out and gathered up all those nails. The nails were extremely valuable. Yeah. And many times all they could do is just cut and make cuts into wood where they'd stand together like the log cabin's logs. But the roofs and everything, they didn't have very many nails because they were so expensive, because they were handmade nails by blacksmiths. Their furniture and utensils were in harmony with the primitive appearance of the rude character of their dwellings being all homemade. And here and there, a few pewter spoons, dishes, and iron knives and forks, with muscles of iron and hearts of oak, they united a tenderness for chivalry, and their indomitable will, which recognized no obstacle as inseparable, and was equaled only by integrity, with regard to dishonesty as a offense, or contemptible as a cowardice. Dishonesty was not allowed. You shook a man's hand, and that was it, and that was to the death. The French settlers. Parkman describes the French settlers in the Kaskaskia, Illinois. The Creole of Illinois contended lighthearted and thriftless, by no means fulfilled the injunction to increase and multiply, and the colony languished in spite of fertile soil. The people labored long enough to gain a bare subsistence for each passing day, and spent the rest of their time dancing and making merry, smoking and gossiping and hunting and drinking. These were the Creole. These were the French Creole now. Their native gaiety was irrepressible, and they found means to stimulate it with wine made from the food of the wild grapevines. Thus they passed their days at peace with themselves, and hand and glove with their Indian neighbors, and ignorant of all the world beside. The French married into the Indian people. There where you have the Louisiana, you have the blacks, you have the French, and you have Indians all crossed up. Money was scarcely known among these people. Skins and furs were the prevailing currency. In every village, a great portion of the land was held in common, not by individual ownership. The religious conditions of these people in this section of the country. An experiment is making in this vast country, which must ultimately contain so many millions of people on the broadest scale on which it has ever been made. Whether religion as a national distinction or of character can be maintained without legislation, aid, and even recognition by the government. They said religion could not be maintained. People would be heathens if you didn't force them to go to church. So here we go, the state and the church again. Wherever they go, we got the state and church. And Catholicism is state and church. French Catholicism, state and church. German Catholicism and state and church. German Lutheranism is state and church. If there are any reference to religion and any of the constitutions and enactments in the Western country beyond the simple occasion of granting of a distinct incorporation, it manifests itself in guarded jealousy of the interference of religious feeling, or influenced with the tenor of legislation. In most of the constitutions and ministers of the gospel are expressly interacted from any office or profit or trust in the gift of the people. In none of these enactments are there any provisions for the support of any form of worship whatsoever. Zero. But if it were inferred from this that religion occupies little or no place in the thoughts of the people, that there are no forms of worship and few ministers of gospel, and no inference can be wider from the fact. It is the settled political maxim of the West that a religion is a concern entirely between the conscience of God, and ought to be left solely to the guardianship and care of each individual. Sound like Baptist, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Ministers are not settled here, except among the Catholics. The Catholics supported their ministers. Baptists didn't support their ministers. Except among the Catholics, there are a few settled pastors in the sense in which the phrase understood in New England and Atlantic cities. Most of the ministers that are in some sense permanent discharge pastoral duties not only in their individual societies, but in wide districts about them. These are the what we call the quarter-time churches. The ministers are going one time a month here, one time a month there, one time a month over there. Quarter time, the traveling minister. The range of duties and the emolument of the estimation of the fact that the whole condition of the Western pastor are more widely different from any Atlantic minister. There are prejudices against contracts between pastors and the people. The people are generally averse to binding themselves by any previous legal obligations to a pastor for services stipulated or to be performed. It is a general impression that he ought to derive his support from voluntary contributions after services performed and uninfluenced by any antecedent contract or understanding. There are many towns and villages where other modes prevail, but such is the general standing and feeling of the West. The West is not destitute of religious instruction. It has been 100 times represented and in every form of intelligence in the Eastern religious publication that there were but few preachers in the country and the whole wide districts had no religious instruction and forms of worship whatsoever. We believe from a survey, certainly very general, and we trust faithful, that there were as many as preachers in proportion to the people as there were in the Atlantic colonies. They just weren't educated. A circulating phalanx of Methodists, Baptists, and Cumberland Presbyterians, and the Latin missionaries and young elders of the Catholic theology seminaries pervades the Great Valley with its numerous detachments from Pittsburgh and the mountains and the lakes and the Missouri to the Gulf of Mexico. There are stationary preachers in towns, particularly in Ohio. Now remember, Ohio, we look at it now, we look at big cities. We look at Illinois' big cities. We look at Kentucky. We look at all of these as great towns, you know, Lexington and et cetera, et cetera. Nashville. But it wasn't so back then. But in the rural congregations to the western country beyond Ohio, it is seldom a minister is stationary for more than 2 months. 9/10 of the religious instruction of the country is given by people who are itinerant and who are, with very few exceptions, notwithstanding that has been said to contrary, men of great zeal and sanctity. They are very pious people. But their teaching of the Bible was rudimentary. Now we have a description of camp meetings. You remember when I was a young man, you remember, girl, you know, Marilyn, when I was young, there were tent meetings down on Union Avenue in Bakersfield. You ever go to any of those?
I heard about them.
You heard about them. I went to them. Suppose the scene be where the most frequent camp meetings have been during the past 2 years in one of the most beautiful fertile valleys among the mountains of Tennessee. On an appointed day, coaches and chaises and wagons and carts and people on horseback and multitudes traveling from a distance on foot, wagons and provisions and mattresses and tents and arrangements for the stay of a week are seen hurrying from every point toward the central spot. It is in the midst of the grove that these beautiful and lofty trees, natural to the valleys of Tennessee, in its deepest verdure, and besides the spring branch for the requisite supply of water, they had to be nearer a spring, the line of tents is pitched. Religious city grows up in a few hours. Under the trees and beside the stream, lamps are hung in lines among the branches, and the effect of their glare upon the surrounding forest is like magic. By this time the moon, for they take thought to appoint the meeting at the proper time of the moon, and begins to show its disk above the dark summits of the mountains, and a few stars are seen glimmering through the intervals of the branches. The whole constitutes a temple worthy of the grandeur of God. An old man, in a dress of the quaintest simplicity, ascends the platform and wipes the dust from his spectacles, and in a voice suppressed by emotion gives out the hymn of which the whole assembly multitude can recite the words, and an air in which every voice can be heard and join in. We should deem poorly of the heart that would not thrill at the song is heard like the sound of many waters, echoing from among the hills and mountains, the hoary oracle tells of God and of the eternity of the judgment to come and all that is impressive beyond. And he speaks of his experiences, his toils and travels, his persecutions and welcomes, how many he has seen in hope and in peace and triumphed and gathered to their fathers. And when he speaks of the short space which remains to him, his only regret is that he can no more proclaim in the silence of death the mercies of the crucified Redeemer. Notwithstanding all of this, the derision of these spectacles, so common in these regions, it cannot be denied that the influence on the whole is salutary and the general bearing upon the great interest of the community good. The gambling and drinking shops are deserted, and the people used to congregate there now go to religious meetings. Now, we're going to begin a period of time in America, one of these CAP meetings, where we have like a Pentecostal element. A Pentecostal element. There was a lot of hype and emotion, not in what we might call a discipline of study, but in emotion. And when you get a people emotionally tied to something, it's awful hard to tell them the truth and bring them out of some errors. It said, the usefulness of the Methodist and Baptist missionaries and missionaries from the East, the Methodists too have gone great and incalculable good. They are generally a character, education, training, and prepare for them the element upon which they are destined to operate. They speak the dialect, the understanding, the interest, and enter into the feelings of their audience. They exhort a prodigious and incalculable bearing upon the rough backwoodsman and do good where more polished and trained ministers could preach without effect. No mind but his own for whom they labor can know how many profane that they have reclaimed and drunkards they have reformed and wanderers they have brought home to God. The Baptists too and the missionaries from the Atlantic country, seeing such a wide and open field before them, labor with great diligence and earnestness and operating generally upon another class of community. The Baptists were the first to enter into the territory and to organize a church. The first church was founded in Ohio called Columbia, now Cincinnati, in 1790. This company has been thus described. It was on the 18th of November, November 1788, that a company of 23 men, and some of them hardly grown, three women and two children, the oldest only 5 years of age, landed from the flat boat on which they had floated down Pittsburgh and began to erect the cabins in which they proposed to spend the winter awaiting the arrival of their relatives, fathers and mothers and wives and children in the spring. Most of these people had come from Essex County in New Jersey, and several of them had been members of the old Scottish Plains Baptist Church, from which the First Baptist Church of New York City had been organized, and of which was the Reverend John Gano. John Gano, keep remembering that name. John Gano was a great preacher. John Gano was the one that converted George Washington. John Gano was the one that preached in the American Revolution to all the soldiers. Right with them, right among the bullets and the cannonballs. Noted for having been among the most efficient, influential captains in the army of the Revolution, had ever been a pastor. The leader of the company and pioneers was Major Benjamin Stites, and later became a prominent in this church. There was also General John Gano and wife. The Reverend Stephen Gano of Providence, Rhode Island. Remember Providence or Rhode Island? What's Rhode Island got to do with it? Rhode Island is the first colony in America that we had religious freedom. And we have to Dr. John Clark, we have Roger Williams, we have John Gano, and we have Stephen Gano of Providence, Rhode Island. Providence and Newport, Rhode Island were the two churches, 1638 and 1639. The next May, the church chose John Smith to be their pastor. And he was a Virginian, a very able, talented man, an excellent orator. whose voice could be heard a great distance in the open air and thus admirably adapted to a new country. He was everywhere heard gaily, happily. For several years, he was very useful till he became involved in politics. The great mistake of his life, as he himself admitted, he was a member of the Convention for the Adoption of the State Constitution for Ohio and of this first senators in Congress. He became intimately acquainted with Aaron Burr and entertained him from week and or more at his own home in Cincinnati. When Burr was suspected of treason, suspicion fell upon Smith. He was tried in the Senate, and although not proved guilty, there were so many against him that he resigned. In 1808, he left Cincinnati for Louisiana, where he lived in obscurity for 16 years till his death. Some of his enemies were bitter persecutors, but those who knew him best had great confidence in him. He made a mistake. He went into politics, and it destroyed his religious life, among others. Associated with John Smith was James Lee of Virginia. He was a man of remarked personality. He had been thus described: he could not read even when of age, but seemed evidently called of God to preach the gospel. He couldn't read. He had hardly heard a sermon till his majority, but soon after licensed to preach by some church in Kentucky. In an excursion through the Miami County, he was called upon Elder Smith on Saturday, and on his way to the church Sunday morning, Elder Smith learned that he was to be a preacher and urged him to preach, though having been traveling for several weeks, he was in no condition to appear in the pulpit. But he yielded to the entreaty and ventured to speak to the people both morning and evening, and this was God's introduction for his servant to some 25 years of usefulness in the Miami Association. These are the other ministers who assisted in distinguished laymen. Two of them were Judge Francis Dunleavy and Judge Matthias Corwin. Judge Dunleavy was one of the early Baptists in the Northwest Territory and the pioneer history of the territory actively shared. He became a member of the Columbian Church in 1792. And one of the conference which took the first steps toward organizing the Miami Association, it was said long after, drew up the Articles of Faith and agreed upon by the Association. He continued an active member of the church in Miami Valley until his death on November the 6th, 1839, a period of 47 years, and had been a member of the Baptist Church some 5 or 6 years previous to uniting with them in the Columbian Church. Judge Matthias Corwin, who had likewise been important political positions, when at home he was always at the post. And so constant was his attendance upon the meetings of the church that if he was missed at any time when at home, it was known that something unusual had detained him. He was frequently one of the messengers of the church to the association, and oftener messenger of the association to some corresponding body, and on several occasions was appointed to prepare a circular corresponding letters of the association as well as the letters of his own church. The settlement was made in perilous times. The Indians made every exertion to cut them off and prevent their settlement. They tried many stratagems to decoy them ashore on their passage down the river, and after they settled, they were continually lurking to destroy them. They were obliged for a number of years to live mostly in forts and blockhouses, but notwithstanding all these precautions, a number of the first settlers fell victims to the rage of the savage neighbors. Now, you couldn't hardly fault these Indians either, because the Catholics had come among them and enslaved them beforehand.
Yeah.
And they didn't think much of religion at all. Many, many Indians don't think much of the white man's religion because of what the Catholic Church did. The Miami Association was founded in 1797 of four churches with about 100 members in all. In 1805, the the Scioto Association was formed from this one, and with four churches, and 3 years afterwards, six other churches were dismissed from the Redstone Association, formed into a new organization. The immigration to Ohio, being principally from those parts of New England where Baptists were few, did not increase in proportion to the population. But in 1825, a great revival was experienced in all the Baptist churches of the state. A great revival. The beginning followed a powerful preaching of Jeremiah Vardiman, then of Kentucky. He held a series of meetings in Cincinnati with great success, several hundred being converted under his ministry in the course of a few weeks. The revival spread to the churches adjacent, and the organization of the Ninth Street Church in Cincinnati was one of the results of S.H. Ford planting the progress of Baptist churches in the valley. The Baptists were the first after Roman Catholics to enter the territory of Illinois. What a deal, huh? This is church history. I know it's in great detail, which I've never done before. But I'm trying to, in these set of messages, I'm trying to give you all the information and all the differences of opinion and all the evolution of theology. And we're going to get, when we get a little bit further, we're going to go into TULIP, and we're going to go into sublapsarian, infralapsarian, and superlapsarian theology and what it is. Because we're going to come into this later. And we need to know how these people thought. The one man there, they said that he believed that all mankind only would be redeemed who Christ had died for. Christ died for all men. But it's only efficacious to what? To the believers. To those that respond, it is efficacious to them. To those that do not respond, it is not efficacious to them, even though Jesus died for all mankind. Matthew 16 and 18 says, he says, "You're Peter, but upon this gigantic foundation rock I'll be building my church, and the gates of hell shall not wrestle her down." The gates of hell have wrestled against God's churches politically, by persecution, and by heresy. My whole job in my life and in my ministry for more than 50 years now is to teach people what the Bible teaches. And it makes them into a Baptist. Church Baptist history and the Bible makes them into Baptists, and that they know what they believe and why they believe it. When you do that, you've got generations of believers. There are people that shy away from the gospel in your own families, your own children. But you need, as parents, to teach your children the way of life and the way of truth and the way of salvation and the truths of God's Word so they'll know what they are. Our Father, we send this message out for your honor and glory. Thank you for it. Thank you that it's written down, that we can study it and go back and see what people fought for so many years ago and how that they, the principles they fought for and died for, or the liberties that we have today. Please help us hold on to those liberties with every bit of might that we have, and know what the truths are, and know what we believe and why we believe it. Please forgive me where I fail you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.